During the Senate debate, it was pointed out that this question was even more important than the question of slavery, because the slavery question only affected people that lived inside the United States. This decision was going to shape the whole world. Those of us in particular who are critical of some of the directions of American foreign policy can also take from this debate the inspiration of realizing that we're not making this up. Actually, we're in a rich American tradition, which in some ways has been denied to us by the disappearance of this story from our history books. We're standing on the shoulders of titans. It's wonderful, I think, for us to realize that this is a debate that is deeply rooted in American history and that our position has a very rich American tradition.
You're listening to Stephen Kinzer on Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and American Empire. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So, Mark Twain. I had grown up with what I now realize is a mistaken and partial view of Mark Twain, which may have been the view that many of you grew up with. So I thought of him as a gentle old guy, beloved by all, who had curly white hair and rocked on his front porch, told funny jokes, and wrote lovely novels. Well, that's a piece of Mark Twain. But Mark Twain was vituperative. He was bitter. His writings were poisonous. So I feel now that we've bleached the image of Mark Twain. We've made him too much into a pleasant dinner guest, when actually he was not a friendly dinner guest at all, as Theodore Roosevelt came to realize. Finally, I had a wonderful discovery in learning about a person who I had never heard of before, who also was a great figure in America in his time. Carl Schurz. He fought in the 1848 revolution in Germany as a teenager. After that rebellion was crushed, he had to flee. He came to America. He became an abolitionist, an admirer of Abraham Lincoln. He was a Civil War general. Then he went on to become a U.S. senator from Missouri, first German-born U.S. senator. He was Secretary of the Interior. And in the late 19th century, he was the preeminent American campaigner against corruption, for good government, for civic virtue, and he was certainly known to every literate American in that period. So Carl Schurz was an extremely thoughtful and articulate anti-imperialist. His speeches are wonderfully shaped and deeply penetrating beyond the issues of the moment to the great themes of American life. On January 2nd, 1899, Carl Schurz was the speaker at the convocation of the University of Chicago. Carl Schurz delivered a stirring 11,000-word address in which he listed every argument in favor of expansion and overseas wars and imperialism and demolished them. The economic argument, the strategic argument, the moral argument, the political argument. Today I'm not going to do the whole 11,000 words. This is an admonition for today. This is Carl Schurz speaking to us. Let us raise high the flag of our country, not as an emblem of reckless adventure and greedy conquest, of betrayed professions and broken pledges, of criminal aggressions and arbitrary rule over subject populations, but the old, the true flag, the flag of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the flag of government of, for, and by the people, the flag of national faith held sacred and of national honor unsullied, the flag of human rights and of good example to all nations, the flag of true civilization, peace, and goodwill to all men. Thanks. Great to be here.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to talk about foreign aid because there are diseases, easily preventable diseases that people in developing nations get that we haven't seen in the West for 50 years, diseases that our pets don't even get. And so I'm all for, like, not waging wars, but what if we wage wars against poverty or against diseases or other types of humanitarian aid causes? Then is American intervention acceptable?
The United States is always going to be intervening in the world just because of our size and our power. It's inevitable. So the key is not to try to prevent this, but to try to shape it in a positive way. You're absolutely right that the United States has a magnificent role to play in the world, as long as it's not confrontational, as long as it's working with other countries instead of against them. One of the things that I notice as I travel around the world is that despite all of our sins, huge numbers of people have tremendous admiration for the United States. They admire us. They want what we have. They want to have a society like ours. The United States has a great story to tell in the world, but we're not telling it. We've given up, essentially, on trying to promote that aspect of our society, which I think is the essence of our society. All of our libraries and America houses and consulates are being turned into fortresses or closed. And now we're giving too many people in the world the idea that the face of America is night raids, drone attacks, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, foreign interventions. This is not who we are, but it's the face that we show too often. Our foreign policy has become heavily militarized. I would love to see a shift from our foreign policy away from military toward diplomatic. You know, Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, famously told his colleague, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, once that he said, "I have more people in my military bands than you have diplomats in the entire State Department." And it's true. That gives you a sense of how imbalanced our approach to the world is. For many years, the United States felt invulnerable. We understood that our foreign interventions created blowback, but it didn't reach our shores. In the modern world, that isolation is over. We need to be thinking more seriously about cooperating with other countries. And allies, partners, only emerge when they like you, when they admire you, when they want to help you, when they feel a sense of common interest. And if we don't project a sense that we're a country that people want to be allied with, they want to ally with us. You know, how many countries in the world are allies of China? China's not a country that automatically makes governments or nations or people think, "I want to be like you. I want to be your friend." But America's the opposite. We draw people by who we are. And that's why it's so important to show people who we really are.
A couple questions. One is, tell us how you chose this particular book? What was the spark that got you on this? And second of all, since we're at Brown, and Brown's most famous diplomat is John Hay. John Hay Library, he coined the term "splendid little war," I believe, to describe the Spanish-American War. And did he play any part in your narrative, in your book?
Well, I read a lot about the Spanish-American War. I know a lot about it, and I teach about it every year. And this story, to me, is a huge part of the Spanish-American War story. You can't tell the story without this. But this piece never appears. And it's somewhere in a book I saw a mention that somebody made a speech at something called the Anti-Imperialist League, which I had never heard of. Then I started reading and began understanding the scope of this institution. And then what were the forces that gave birth to the Anti-Imperialist League? Now, what was the debate? And this led me to realize how close the debate was. Then I began plunging myself into the original sources and realized that this was an enormous episode that shook a nation and shook the world. People were watching the Senate debate all over the world. Diplomats posted in Washington were sending out reports every day. So I came to realize there was a big piece of the story missing, and I set out to find it. It's pretty hidden. As for John Hay, he did play a role in this. So he was Secretary of State under both McKinley and Roosevelt, as Roosevelt kept him on after McKinley's assassination. John Hay, of course, had seen the entire second half of the 19th century. He had gone from being private secretary to Abraham Lincoln to being Secretary of State 50 years later under McKinley. You know, at Brown, he was known as Hashish Johnny. I'm not going any further into that one. But he had some interesting aspects to his life. I'll tell you another one. While he was working with Henry Cabot Lodge to push the Treaty of Paris through the Senate, he was having an affair with Lodge's wife. I think that Hay was one of the more reluctant imperialists. He did support, naturally, the project. He was the Secretary of State. But I think he also did understand some of the problems that this might cause. Hay was a calming influence on both McKinley and Roosevelt. He was also a great writer and a great phrase maker. That's why he came up with this wonderful phrase for the Spanish-American War, a splendid little war.
I wonder how much of the change in our foreign policy do you think it's because of the priorities of the plutocrats?
I think quite a bit, depending on how you define plutocrats. Certainly, the what we call the defense industry is a very powerful force in shaping American policy. Every time one of these giant procurement projects for something like the F-35 aircraft is approved by Congress, the first thing the defense contractors do is slice up the contract and give pieces of it to every district of a congressman who has an important vote in Washington. It means that the congressmen are then immobilized. They can't vote against these projects because otherwise they're throwing people out of work in their own districts. And I can sympathize with that, but it's a fiendishly effective technique, especially when combined with the campaign contributions to favored senators. In addition, the economic motive has always been an important part of the American push abroad. It's too simple to say that we fight all our foreign wars for plunder, but there's always been an aspect of that. This argument comes very strongly to the fore. The resources of the Philippines were a great topic during the Senate debate. In fact, Senator Albert Beveridge, the only senator who actually went to the Philippines and was a great imperialist, came back and gave a list of all the products that the Philippines produced and talked about how rich the land was. And he actually held up a gold nugget that he said he had picked out of a river in the Philippines. You couldn't have had a more graphic image of what American foreign policy is all about. So the resources of the Philippines were important to us, but also the markets. One of the things that comes very clear as you read through the newspapers and magazines of that era, as I did, is that an obsession in that period was what was called glut. So American farmers and manufacturers were producing more than Americans could consume. And this was causing problems in the United States. That was the root of labor upheaval. We had strikes. We had Pinkertons shooting down labor leaders on the streets in many cities. There were worries about instability in the U.S. And the theme of these articles always at the end is, we need foreign markets. And you can't trade with Europe because Europe has tariff walls. You can't trade with European colonies because that was the whole point of taking colonies. You trade with them and no one else can. So we need colonies of our own. The Philippine market was seen as a great lure, but the big one was the China market. You hear about this all the time in these articles. It's a great Fata Morgana out there that the Philippines could be our springboard into the China market. And there are articles speculating on how many head of cattle we could sell in a year in China if we could get the Chinese to eat beef instead of rice and vegetables. Or if we could get the Chinese to wear cotton clothing. How much cotton could you export in a year? These were great, fascinating prospects for American business people. In the current age, foreign policy is aimed at protecting our security, and that's economic in part. I think that's actually a reasonable goal for foreign policy of any country, to protect your national economy. I like to think that the United States should define its vital interests down very narrowly, because vital interests are the ones you want to go to war for. But protecting the sea lanes, for example, on which our economy depends, is a very legitimate vital interest of the United States. On the other hand, we sometimes follow policies for economic purposes, and then after the economic purposes are gone, we still keep following them. One of the great weaknesses of American foreign policy is its lack of agility. We don't change when the world changes. And a great example, talking about economics, is the Persian Gulf. We have ships all over the Persian Gulf. I was just there over the winter break, and it's a narrow waterway just made for confrontation. We have our whole Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain. Why are we there? Well, we're there for two reasons. One is to keep the Soviet Union out, and the other is to assure that the Saudi oil on which our economy depends can get to us safely. But neither of those applies anymore. Actually, the oil that goes through the Persian Gulf, that Saudi oil that we're spending billions of dollars to protect, it's going to China. We're paying to keep the Persian Gulf safe for Chinese and Japanese and Indian oil. So the economic motive is always there. It's not the one we hear about. As I mentioned earlier, the humanitarian motive is the one that people like to trot out when they want to promote interventions. And whatever the real motivation is, I would always advise the president, cloak it in some kind of bogus humanitarian concern or real humanitarian concern, and then you'll get people to support it. But behind that lies much more.
Were there any antecedents to this debate in the conquest of Native American lands moving west and south?
America's progression to empire came in phases. And I would single out three. I'd say there were three phases. The first phase, as you point out, was what I would call continental empire. We cleared out the Indians or put them in reservations. We captured half of Mexico and we created our empire in North America. The second stage came as a result of the debate that I spoke about today. That brought us from being a continental empire to being an offshore empire, or an overseas empire. And then after World War II, we took the final step and became a global empire. So you're right, expansionism was not anything new, as the expansion of the United States into the rest of North America also constituted expansionism. The Mexican War did arouse controversy, and Abraham Lincoln was one of the few who spoke up as a member of Congress. It's one of the reasons that he lost. You know, Abraham Lincoln served one term in Congress and then was defeated. One of the main reasons was his opposition to the Mexican War. I don't think there was much opposition to American policies toward the Indians, largely for racial reasons. Very few Americans would have thought that Indians were in a position to govern themselves or have any kind of civilized life. They were barbarians and headhunters like Theodore Roosevelt would have called him. In fact, he had a famous line: I don't believe that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. But I do think that 9 out of 10 are, and I wouldn't argue too much about the 10th. So that kind of attitude, I think, prevented any sympathy for the Indians or for the Mexicans. There was I wouldn't want to say a crescendo, there was a peep. There were a few peeps of protest. But that intervention happened very quickly, and in fact, Polk didn't even run for re-election after he had accomplished it. So I think the real debate over expansionism did not begin until we began to expand overseas. Don't forget that manifest destiny, that phrase was coined to mean it's our manifest destiny to fill up North America. Everybody in America believed that, with the exception of the poor victims. But it was when we decided to push beyond our geographical boundaries that we set off a national debate.
You worked for the New York Times as a writer, and you touched upon the differences from the time that you worked there and today. Do you think things are worse, better, the same?
I think there have been great moments in the history of the American press, but not enough of them. I was at the New York Times during the run-up to the Iraq War. It was very disturbing to me to see how the New York Times was beating the war drums with aluminum tubes and uranium from Niger and all of this. In fact, it was a factor in my decision to leave the New York Times. As a New York Times reporter, I wasn't able to say anything about what I really thought about the Iraq preparations and what nonsense it was that we were printing in our newspaper. But I thought if I weren't at the New York Times, I would be allowed to say that. So that was a factor in leading me to want to liberate myself. The great change in coverage of foreign news since I was a foreign correspondent is that so much foreign news reporting that you see in the American press now is written from Washington. I always like to look at the dateline. So if I'm getting the analysis of what's really happening in Mali and it's datelined Washington, I don't read it. Because I know how those reporters operate. You got a story to write. So you call the State Department. Then you call the Defense Department. You might call someone you know in the White House. You might call a couple of embassies, and then you call the think tank expert. Then you say, well, I've covered every base. I got a full story now. That's not correct. You're talking to all people who are in the same echo chamber. And that is very pernicious. So the days are gone when it was possible to do what I used to do, for example. I can remember in Istanbul, from Istanbul calling my boss in New York and saying, I think I'd like to go to Uzbekistan for 2 weeks. And the answer to the question came back, so what's happening in Uzbekistan? I said, I don't know. Got to find out, but I'll get you some great stories. And he said, fine, take a photographer. That doesn't happen anymore. Unless there's some hard news happening, nobody gets sent. And this is why I hate news. I can admit this now after so many years as a newsman. Because news is a big distraction. News is what's happening today, right now. But that's not what's important. Two other things are more important than what's happening today. One is, what happened yesterday? How did we get here? Why is this happening? And the other is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What does it mean, what just happened? So I'm dedicated more into looking at the causes and effects rather than the actual episode. When you're so obsessed with the daily news cycle, you never ask those questions. And that's the whole point. I try to break out of that syndrome.
Just an observation, like we talked about manifest destiny. You know, this country was founded on that concept, if you look at it. I mean, here are these people left England because of religious oppression, came here and created theocracies in every state except for this one. So it's pretty much ingrained in the psyche of probably all people to some extent. And I guess the idea is it probably comes down to an individual assessing that and finding out how we participate in that, basically.
I think you're right, but I would just take exception to one thing you said, and that is it's the same for all peoples. I think there's something special about Americans. Mm-hmm. Who are the people that would have wanted to come over here? I read Jim Webb's great book about the Scotch-Irish. That's his people. These were fighters. They were fighters in Scotland. They were fighters in Ireland. They came over here. Andrew Jackson and all these people came out of that same fighting tradition. Americans have a desire to win, to command, to dominate. Not everybody nation in the world feels that way. Americans are brought up with Calvinist ideals. One is the world is divided between good and evil. Many people in many cultures don't learn that. They're taught that we're all somewhat good and somewhat evil, and these qualities come out in different proportions according to different circumstances. We don't believe that. Calvinists also believe that it's not enough to sit home and hope that bad things stop happening and good things begin happening. You have to go out in the world and do God's work. We have a real missionary complex. Let me just close with this observation. It goes back to George Washington's farewell address. So this speech is sometimes dismissed as quaint and old-fashioned and applying to an era that's long gone. But I don't see it that way. To me, it's full of great wisdom for America. So he listed in his farewell address in 1796 the traps that America should avoid if it wants to avoid being dragged down like other great nations have been. Here are some of them. Frequent collisions, obstinate, envenomed, and bloody contests. Overgrown military establishments. Excessive partiality for one foreign nation and excessive dislike of another. The illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists. And projects of hostility instigated by pride, ambition, and other sinister and pernicious motives. Now, in his speech at the end, Washington admits that he realizes Americans are not going to pay attention to his rules. I dare not hope they will make the strong and lasting impression I would wish. Nonetheless, he insists on proclaiming the one principle that he says will prevent our nation from running the course which has hitherto marked the destiny of nations. Give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? I'm going to leave you with that one, our founder. Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Stephen Kinzer on Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and American Empire. He spoke at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island in 2017. This classic from the AR Archive was recorded in 2017 at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Stephen Kinzer was a New York Times correspondent and bureau chief in Nicaragua, Germany, and Turkey. He currently teaches at Brown. He's the author of many books, including Overthrow, All the Shah's Men, The Brothers, and The True Flag. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Stephen Kinzer on Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and American Empire, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
I push through those double doors with bloodshot eyes, too exposed in the fluorescent light. Book bag on my back, I raise the bell that howls, dodging teachers on the crowd. And a pinky swear, she said it was between us with a flip of her blonde hair. Like a canary in a coal mine, I can't get past that Black Hawk County line. I knew something was up from all the whispered stares and the lack of available lunchroom chairs. Realized with a flash of adrenaline the trouble my big mouth has got me in. Good old Hudson High has a bold new headline. Out into the town I can no longer hide. Rumors confirmed about me on my head. Their laughter turns my face fire engine red. Like a canary in a coal mine, I can't get past that Black Hawk County line. Yippee-ki-yay-yay-yay, someday I'll fly away. Yippee-ki-yay-yay-yo, past the grain silos where the tall corn grows, past the buzzing quick star sign, across the Black Hawk County line. The Black Hawk County. Distance and time taught me I wasn't broken, but part of me is still behind the Black Hawk County line. The Black Hawk County line.
It's the most